Hi, this is David Russell. Welcome to episode 46 of the No Bad Bosses podcast. Today's episode is sponsored by Dave's Charm School. This is soft skills training for your people. How do they communicate? How do they get along with one another? How do they avoid confrontation and conflict? And all kinds of soft skills that are important. We've even got one on business etiquette that's a blast. Do you know the 30 tips, the 30 things you need to remember when you're out dining with a client? Hey, business etiquette, that's the course for you. Check it out. You can get 14 days free. Go to davescharmschool.com. There's no apostrophe on the S, just D-A-V-E-S, charmschool.com. And take 14 days free. Try it out. Check it out with your people. There's quizzes online to confirm they learn the content. There's badges, points, the whole thing. Lots of fun. Now, my guest today is Corey Kupfer. He's a strategist, a deal maker, and a business consultant. He's also an attorney who really has some fascinating things to say about how to negotiate and how to get people to come together. He focuses on the word authentic and authentic negotiating and authentic business academy and really being a real person. And it's awesome. One of the best we've had so far. Here we go. Okay, we're live. So Corey Kupfer, I am so glad to have you on the show. And you have a really interesting background coming from law into consulting and still doing both. Why don't you let our audience know, you know, where you come from and why you're doing what you're doing today, and then we can dive into your passions.
Sure. So, listen, I grew up in Brooklyn. I got to start there because, you know, Brooklyn is, you know, is one of my passions because that's where I come from. But, I spent most of my time in New York, and I came up, through college and law school in New York area, went to NYU, and I went to, into big, you know, New York City firm practice for 5 years. And then, decided I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And frankly, I've been an entrepreneur since I was 15. So I actually had a business when I was 15, with employees, right? I used I used to deliver flyers door to door in Brooklyn working for somebody, and they'd pay you a penny a piece, or if they had, it was like supermarket circulars, and you'd put them in people's screen doors, you know? And, if you had two of them, they'd pay a penny and a half. And I would stop in stores on the way, on my route while I was working for somebody, and I would say, hey, we have a business delivering flyers. You know, we can do it for you. And I got my own accounts and hired my friends and, made 1976, 77, I was making $300 a week as a 15-year-old kid, which was like ridiculous money, you know?
That's right.
The only thing I didn't understand back then, I understood cash flow, but I didn't understand enterprise value. So when I went away to college, instead of selling it, I just gave it up. I didn't understand it then. You know? So went to college, went to law school. So always had those entrepreneurial, you know, tendencies. And frankly, it was end of 91, beginning of 92. It was a horrible market. I mean, the economy was terrible. They were laying off lawyers all over the place. And I ridiculously decided I had enough working for someone else and I would start my own firm. Everybody told me I was crazy, you know, because it was a horrible economy, and I hung out a shingle and I was working out of my studio apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan and renting a conference room by the hour down at 67 Wall Street. And, you know, they had this new technology back then where they had phone back and computer where you can call in and it would come up on the screen and they would say Corey Kupfer's office and they could transfer it to me in my studio apartment on the Upper East Side, like I was in, you know, which of course now is like, you know, whatever, but back then it was new. And that's how I started, you know, and I built a firm from nothing. And I've been doing it for over 30 years on the law firm side. And, I started doing, you know, work for the teachers union legal plan at $65 an hour. And all my friends who were charging $200 an hour or whatever it was back then, they said, why are you working for $65 an hour? And I said, you don't understand the menu. The menu is not 200 versus 65. The menu is zero versus 65. You know, it's a better option. In any case, over time, we built a nice practice. I brought in a partner, you know, in 2 years, another one, 3 years. And, you know, the firm's gone through various iterations over the 30 some odd years, but, you know, we still have that going and we do corporate work. We work with entrepreneurial and larger companies to help them grow. So everything from startup through exit, M&A deals, licenses, we do ventures, contract strategy, negotiating, and that kind of stuff. And then I started speaking as a sideline. I started speaking, you know, for business development, and then people started paying me to speak. And I was like, this is pretty cool. You're gonna cut me a check to speak to my prospective clients. I think I kind of like this, you know? So I did that for, I don't know, 15 plus years. And then a couple of years ago, I wrote a book, Authentic Negotiating, a little mini plug here. I decided to separate out the training, consulting, speaking that I had been doing as an adjunct as a sideline to the law firm into its own company with its own business model, with its own team. And I've been focusing a lot of my time on that. I've got a phenomenal team in the law firm that does a lot of the work. I do the high level stuff, and I'm doing a lot of the speaking, training, consulting, and writing now.
So when you talk about authentic, and don't be offended, but normally when you go and try to find an attorney, speaking from my own experience at 61 with 45 years business experience, like yourself, starting when I was 16, and one of the things is, do I trust this person? And a kind of a synonym of that trust is the person going to be authentic? And so when you talk about authentic negotiating, what are kind of the key attributes of that? And I would assume that's also, you've got Authentic Enterprises, Authentic Business Academy. I would assume part of your thing is being an authentic leader. I mean, why did you latch on to authentic?
Yeah, so for me, it's just a core to who I am. I've always had an issue, like on the negative side of it, when I was growing up, I always had an issue with people who were hypocritical or not, or had this false front on. You can sense it, and as you get older and you can read people more and you have more experience, it even gets worse, right? And it does, And listen, and unfortunately, my profession, it's fun. It's funny with the law, right? I mean, there's all the lawyer jokes out there. There's issues, and listen, some of them stem from problems with some aspects of my profession. I'll be straight up. And at the same time, every business person knows they need a great lawyer that they can trust.
That's right.
To help them do their deals. Absolutely. And their contracts and the strategy and whatever. And for me, though, the authenticity part comes from, it's not a conversation of morals or ethics. It's a conversation of doing the deep inner work to get truly aligned with what your truth is, and then to be able to show up fully, right, without any, like who you are, like to be able to live the life who you are. So interestingly, in the law firm, my clients, listen, sometimes we would get referred in to paper a deal, right? Somebody had referred us in on a merger and they had already negotiated the terms and they needed the legal documents. Sure, we'll do that. But most of my clients were long-term clients, and they would come to me very early in the process. Hey, Corey, I'm thinking about buying a company. I'm thinking about bringing in a partner. I'm thinking about going into this. What do you think? And I became a trusted advisor for them. And one of the reasons was because I would ask them questions that a lot of lawyers wouldn't ask them, right? So if they said, hey, Corey, I'm thinking about doing, bringing a partner or acquiring a company, instead of just saying, okay, what are the deal terms? How is it going to be set up? What percentage they get? I would ask them why to start with. Like, why? What's your vision for this? What's your purpose for this? How does this align with, what are your goals and objectives? So I always served in a way as a coach, even when I was, just had a lawyer hat on. So for me, and then of course I had my own personal journey around my own authenticity. Not that I always felt like I was an honest and trustworthy person, but I used to have different aspects of myself. So, I have my lawyer personality, and then there are some causes that I really care about. So I'd be involved with nonprofits and, be active and things like hunger and race relations and whatever. And that was sort of over here. And then, I had we all do this. We have different personas. I was always interested in how do I show up fully as myself in every situation, with all of me, where I don't have to just pick an aspect of my personality, where I can be fully who I am. And that's what led me to this, to this inquiry. And what I found is that I think pretty much everybody's dying to do that. Everybody just wants to get in touch with who they truly are, live the life of purpose that, whatever they're here to do and to be. And to have that be able to show up in every situation they're in and not have to, fake or limit themselves. So that's the deeper conversation. I can talk more specifically about, authentic negotiating and things like that, but that's where it comes from for me.
Yeah. And so, well, what I find interesting in what you just said was that you had a natural ability to shift from your lawyer hat, you know, to use that analogy, take off the lawyer hat. Okay, now I'm going to put on my business owner hat. And you knew that, and you started asking questions that helped them determine whether they were going to make a good decision or not, versus just, okay, I've got some money I'm going to make on the lawyer side, and I'm going to run down this, you know, deal, and I have to serve them only as a lawyer. You were wise enough. Did something happen earlier in your career, or was that just a natural thing where you kind of knew there's some value I can add here by putting on the business hat?
You know, I think there was two things. I think some of it was innate and natural, just sort of, you know, how I grew up. But then also, frankly, I worked in a couple of firms before I started my own firm in New York City, and I got to see what the models are of the law partners who were there, and there were some good ones and some not good ones, you know, and I saw how they treated clients. I saw how they treated associates, listen, traditionally the work environment in major New York City law firms is not great, right? You know, people working 80 hours a week, they're not appreciated. And that's sort of what drove me to open my own firm. I said, there's got to be a better way, right? And part of that better way was approaching things differently with clients and approaching things differently with the team, with employees. And I think the combination of me being a national entrepreneur and, you know, and running businesses, I mean, I say since I was 15, I mean, I was shoveling snow and mowing lawns, whatever, before that. But like my first real business with employees, you know, was 15. And, you know, here's the thing with lawyers and business people. There's an inherent conflict, and it's the way they think and the way they're trained. See, to be successful in business, you need to take risk, right? I mean, if you don't take risk in business, I'm not talking about wild risk, but, you know, you need to take risk in business to be successful. Lawyers are trained to avoid risks, to identify risks, to avoid risk. You know, we go over cases in law school and everything that could possibly go wrong. You know, you don't study stuff that went right. It doesn't go to court, right? So, you know, so lawyers are so trained to, you know, to naturally be more risk averse, to look for everything that could go wrong, that a lot of my colleagues have trouble with balance. I mean, that, by the way, that's a useful skill, and it's appropriate. Yeah. One of the roles of a lawyer should be look at, you know, what may go wrong and try to anticipate that. That's important. But you need to balance that against the opportunity, the business opportunity. And a lot of lawyers aren't great at that. I think because I have both this law, you know, mind and being an entrepreneur, I sort of get that. And business people like that because they understand the balance. So my job is not to eliminate risk for my clients. They wouldn't be successful. My job is to make sure they're taking knowing risks, right? So they know the risks involved. They balance that against the opportunity, and they get to make a business decision.
Yeah, it makes sense. Well, they're taking authentic risks, right?
Well, hopefully. Listen, here's the thing. So many of us are driven by so many things that are external to ourselves, or that are internal to ourselves that are problematic, like our egos or our fear or our scarcity, or having to prove something to somebody else or wanting to look good. You know, I mean, even around, I'm very active in Entrepreneurs Organization, which is a phenomenal organization, peer-to-peer learning, supporting entrepreneurs to grow. And this, you know, in the entrepreneurial world, even there, but certainly outside of there, even more so, you know, there's this thing about everybody's got to grow, everybody's got to scale, and everybody's got, you know, and lifestyle business is a negative thing. And you know, I did an interview once. I said everybody's business should be a lifestyle business. And they looked at me like, what? I said, well, because lifestyle business doesn't to me necessarily mean small. It means to me, why do you become an entrepreneur? The only reason to become an entrepreneur in my mind is that you get to, you know, dictate your own terms. You don't work for somebody. You get to create the life that you want to create. So if the life you want to create is, you know, a small company with you as a solo or a couple of people, and that works for you, that's great. If you want to conquer the world and be the next Elon Musk or, you know, or whoever, right, and change the world and have hundreds of thousands of employees, a great technology, and that's true to who you are, then that's a lifestyle business for me, because it's creating the lifestyle that you want. Too many people end up doing things because of factors. You know, we become entrepreneurs, we're going to call our own destiny, and then we're doing stuff because we care about what our parents think or our peers think, or because, you know, our ego gets engaged, or because we're afraid if we don't do it that way. You know, that's not true freedom. And my highest ideal is freedom. That's why I become an entrepreneur.
Yeah, that's great. And so how does that transfer over to authentic negotiating?
Yeah, great. So the thing about negotiating, a lot of the training out there is about tactics and counter tactics, right? You know, if they do this and then you do that. And then, by the way, there are counter tactics to the counter tactics, right? So, you know, there's always a move. It's a game. And I'm not saying, so a lot of that stuff is manipulative and it really doesn't work. Yeah. Okay. I mean, it may quote unquote work with an unsophisticated party on the other side, in a minor negotiation where you can get over temporarily. Right. But if you have any kind of integrity, if you want to be successful over the long term, that's not what you want. You want to build authentic relationships. You want to do successful deals in the long term, not get over on somebody in the short term. So that's number one. Then there are some good tactics and techniques and counter tactics. I'm not saying there isn't some of that stuff that's useful. The thing is, though, it's not at the core of true negotiating success. Because if you go into a negotiation and you're in a place of scarcity, desperation, or you let your ego get engaged so that, you know, it triggers I don't care what tactics you put on top of that. You're not going to be successful. Now, if you do the internal work that I teach and then you put some good tactics and techniques and frameworks on top of it, then you're in great shape. So my core framework for authentic negotiating is CDE, right? So the C stands for clarity. It's amazing. I know people go into multi-million dollar negotiations without total clarity on exactly what works for them, what doesn't work for them, what their objectives are, right? And I test this with people, right? There's an easy way. The example I often give is around money because it's easy, but it could apply to any term of the deal. So I'll say to a client, it's what I call my true bottom line test. Client says, Corey, I'm selling my business. Okay, great. You know, help me negotiate the terms. No problem. What do you want to get for the business? Okay, well, I'd love to get $15 million. Okay, what would you accept? Well, $12 million. What's your bottom line? What's the lowest, you know, you'll go? All right, $10 million. Okay, great. So $10 million. That's great. Because, listen, you're going to design the whole negotiating strategy around that clarity on the $10 million, on how it's going to be paid, on how long you have to continue to work there as a consultant employee, all the terms, right? And if you don't know what those are, you don't know what the bottom line is, how can you design a negotiating strategy and how do you know when to give and not to give? So then I'll test them and I'll say, okay, David, you said that $10 million is your bottom line. Let's assume on the other 10 or 12 important points of the deal, how you get paid, how long you have to work, whatever the key employees you want to make sure get hired, you got everything you wanted. Everything you wanted. Every other term of the deal, you got exactly what you wanted. But the purchase price is not $10 million. It's $9,999,999.99. What do you do? And inevitably, the client says, well, Corey, it's a penny. Of course I do the deal.
Yeah.
Wrong answer. Why? What about a penny less than that? A penny less than that? A penny less than that? At some point, you end up at zero. So what I'm talking about is the level of crystal clarity that is not a penny less than, not a penny more than, not a day less than, not a day more than, right? Not to be rigid, but to get that level of clarity so you really know what your starting point is. So that's the C. Then the D is detachment.
Well, you know, before you go on to the D, because you're on a roll, I hate to
interrupt. No, it's great. Don't worry.
But I'm just reminded of Zig Ziglar's training, you know, the sales trainer who was so great, passed away a few years ago. But he was awesome. And I remember he always said that if you could get somebody to bend just a little, then you can get them to bend a lot. But you have to break that initial point. And that's kind of what you were saying, a dropping from the 10 million to one penny less. Once they're willing to move beyond that point where they say, I'm not crossing this line at 10 million, once you get them to drop below that, then they're in no man's land.
Yeah, there's no ground. There's no basis, yeah. And it's different if you're gonna as a strategy put out 12 and you know you'll take 10 and you got some room there, but there's gotta be a point at which you have that clarity on, and it's based upon what works for you and what doesn't work for you. And you get deal creep in these negotiations where, you know, because people get afraid, because they feel like they're invested so much time, because they've started spending the money in their mind, you know, they're going to sell their company. They already told their spouse that they're going to take that trip around the world that they promised them, you know, they would do. And they already started planning the trip and, you know, whatever. And the deal's not done. They keep going further and it's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the D?
So the D is detachment. Okay. And what that means is that if you and I are negotiating a deal, I should probably have a preference. We get the deal done. Why am I wasting my time talking to you if I don't have a preference? But ultimately, I need to be detached to the outcome. And the best negotiators, the master negotiators, first of all, you, you have to get clarity first, because or else you don't know what to be detached from, right? So, but if you've got your clarity, then I have to ultimately be equally okay if I do a deal with David or I don't, because either we can do a deal that meets my objectives and obviously, hopefully yours, right? But that meets my objectives, or we don't. And if we don't, right, in my simple example, if you'll only pay, you know, $9 million instead of $10 million, right? Or, you know, I need it paid over 2 years and you won't want to pay me over 10 years or whatever it is. And it doesn't work for you to meet what my, you know, terms that I need, my objectives are, then yeah. That's okay. You're not a bad guy. I shouldn't be upset with you. We're just not meant to do a deal right now. And that's equally okay as doing a deal, because the only thing that's worse than not doing a deal is doing a bad deal.
Yep. Okay. I like it. Good. So what's the E?
So the E is equilibrium, right? So it's how do I maintain my equilibrium, my center, during the negotiation? So let's say we've even done the work to get clear. We go in detached. We understand that, hey, it works or it won't work. But then we go into the negotiation. And then somebody says to you, your company is only worth half that, and it pisses you off. Or, you know, you get afraid of losing the deal. Or somebody pulls some tactic on you and you get triggered by it, right? I mean, these are all the things that happen in a negotiation. And we get thrown off our equilibrium. And then what happens is we lose our detachment and we lose connection to our clarity. And even though maybe we felt like we prepped, you know, on the other two beforehand, we're in trouble. So there's some things that I teach in the work I do. I have a tool called CPR. We don't have to get into it now unless you want to, but like there are ways I teach people how to maintain their equilibrium during the negotiation. So if, my argument is if you have clarity, maintain detachment and maintain your equilibrium, right? I don't care what tactic or counter tactic or whatever, you know, other people do, you're going to be fine. And compared to any tactic or counter tactic that you would learn, that's what's going to make the difference. Now, again, if you add some of the non-manipulative, you know, frameworks and tactics and things that you learn on top of that, that's fine.
Yeah. You know, I'm struck. I come back to your authentic word, and I'm thinking these are clients who you've worked with often for a while. You know them. What type of tips would you have for someone that are part of the process you go through to help your clients understand themselves better? Because you kind of brought it up. I'm not going to use your exact words, but they've got their wounds. They've got their life experience. They've got their biases. And many times they don't understand them. But the impression I got is working with you, you've got enough experience. You've seen enough of this stuff where you kind of help bring some of that stuff to the surface. You kind of peel back the onion to layers that they wouldn't get to on their own. I'm kind of curious about that.
Yeah, no question. And listen, I want to make clear, I'm not a therapist or, you know, there are places where, I mean, you know, when I'm working with somebody on a deal or a negotiation, we're not necessarily going to resolve all of their issues from their childhood or whatever. But you're right. We do go some layers, you know, deeper on the onion, because I'm really going to push them on what their vision is and why and what, you know, and what drives them. Right. Yeah. And, you know, and there's a big difference. Like I give this example, it's a simple example, more, you know, less in deals and more in like salary negotiation. Right. And I say, okay, you know, somebody wants to get a raise. Okay. And you say, why? Well, they say, I want to make more money. Yeah. Well, so, you know, Honda used to use this great technique. The company and the founder came up with it, the five whys, right? You ask why five times to get deeper. So it's a nice little tool. So why do you want to make more money? Well, you know, I got some kids going to college and I need to fund that. Okay. Why is that important to you? Well, you know, I didn't have the opportunity to go to college and I really want my kids to have a better opportunity than I did. Right. And we can keep going, but you see how we're getting deeper. Like there's a big difference between, I just want to make more money to, I never had the opportunity to go to college. And it's really important for me, you know, to send my kids to college. Right. Yeah. That's, I mean, now we're getting to the why. Now, how does that, the deeper conversation, now how does that play out practically? You say, okay, great. Now you know that. What's the difference? Well, we just determined it's important you to fund your kids' college education. Well, if you go to your boss and you say, I want more money, and the boss says, we have nothing, we can't do it, we don't have the budget, right? And the only thing you have to say is, I want more money, it's a dead end, right? But if you've gotten to the why and you're willing to share it authentically with your boss, you can say, listen, it's not just about making more money for me, right? It's super important for me that I send my kids to college and if I have that opportunity, whatever. Maybe, and I'm not, like, you never know, right? But maybe what that triggers is the boss to say, you know what, I don't have money in the budget, but you know what, the company has a scholarship program. Or not the company, but I know somebody, right, at some foundation that gives scholarships to, right? In other words, it opens up other possibilities because it does two things. One, it gets to the core of it. So, you know, you're not just, and two, it creates a good boss is gonna relate to that. They're gonna empathize with it. They're gonna want to help that person, and they're probably, you know, more likely to go out of their way than somebody just says, I want a $5,000 raise.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the boss may say, oh, well, that's really, I can see how that's important. You know, maybe if you took on this project or you did this metric, or maybe, you know, you're not in the right role where you're going to be able to make that kind of money.
Right.
So we need to put you on a career path to move you to this other role, which I think you'd be great in, but you got to learn some new stuff. You got to get some new experiences. It might take 6 months. It might take 6 years. I don't know what it is, but I'm glad you let me know this now, but your concept of authenticity, what I'm hearing you say is that if you have a good boss, that's critical, which you shouldn't be there if you don't have a good boss.
Exactly.
Then that person's going to help you get there. They're going to help you cross that chasm because it's a win-win for everybody. Well, as long as it's not ridiculous, you know?
That's right. That's right. I mean, obviously there's parameters, but the point is it opens up potential opportunities that wouldn't otherwise be there. And a lot of times people are afraid to be that authentic, right? Yeah. Right. Listen, you know, I remember when I first started working, there was a way that I, you know, was supposed to keep my hair, and there was, you know, we only wore blue and gray suits, and, you know, you had to wear a certain tie, and it was the 80s. So we wore braces and suspended, you know, like there's a persona that, you know, and, you know, no matter what, and listen, I don't care, you know, in tech, you do a lot in tech, right? You know, in tech, they say, oh, we wear whatever we want. No, you all wear the same kind of jeans and t-shirt. That's, you know, like, you don't wear a suit. It's a different uniform, right? It's, you know, most of us are conforming to something, and I'm not criticizing that. It is the way of the world to some extent. And you know, you don't necessarily have to be the person that doesn't fit in. But my point is that there's so much that's set up, especially in the corporate world, for us to be, you know, not be fully authentic. And there's so many advantages to doing it. And, you know, what I say a lot of times, I do this talk on building authentic business relationships, right? And what I say is, there's all these people that are walking around with these personas on, they're all dying to let that mask down and to just be who they are, right? But they're all afraid that nobody else, you know, what are they going to look like? And inevitably what happens in most situations is when somebody's willing to do it, it actually gives other people permission to do it. And everybody's happy about it because nobody wants to be walking around with that, holding that persona, you know, like nobody wants it. It's just everybody's afraid to be the first one to break it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm kind of curious, as you extend this into your authentic business academy, what types of things do you cover there?
Yeah, so there's four offerings that are part of that academy, it's in the works for probably be a year and a half from now, where we want to do a big event that includes all of it. So I have the authentic negotiating, right, which we talked about. I have authentic deal making, which includes a piece of authentic negotiating, but there's a lot of other things around doing deals, whether that it's a merger, whether it's a partnership deal or anything like that, that where authenticity comes in. And then there's authentic business relationships, which we touched on a little bit, but how do you build those, whether it's with team in your organization or whether it's with prospects or clients or referral sources, you know, outside. And I talk about some stuff around that, which we can get into if you want. And then the final thing, and this is interesting, because this is an interesting, you know, the conversation I brought up about my own journey, about bringing all of who I am together. So yeah. The fourth one is I have something called Authentic Conversations About Difference. And what was separate for many years, I had this project called Conversations About Race. And so I do my lawyer stuff, I do my speaking stuff. And then I would have this project that I created in 2000 in which people had one-on-one cross-cultural dialogues about race. And we did events at like the Brooklyn Academy of Music. We had 110 people having 55 one-on-one cross-cultural dialogues about race. I did it at the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa in 2001, college campuses, all this kind of stuff. And the whole intention of that project is that people, it's not about the issues. It's not about, you know, affirmative action or institutional racism. It's about people of different backgrounds getting connected in a safe environment where, and really it's about authenticity and intimacy, because what people do is they talk about, we have a way we set them up, and they talk about, what was it like for me growing up? What was it like for you growing up? What I always want to know about your group. And these conversations have been profound. I mean, stories I could tell that would bring me to tears on what's come out of these workshops. But it was always separate for me, right? It was always separate. And then when it all came together for me in terms of this authenticity brand, quote unquote, but really the brand comes from, you know, the whole of who I am. I said, wow, okay, so now it's going to be authentic conversations about race, because that's really what it's been. I just haven't called it that. And we can apply this methodology outside of race. A lot of people have told me that, you know, you can apply it to any difference, age, gender, you know, you name it, right? A culture. Yeah. So I broadened it for the corporate market, and it's called Authentic Conversations About Difference. And it's an opportunity to bridge any kind of difference or gap that there is, you know, in your culture and an organization.
So I'm kind of curious, two things. One, I'm curious on the what attracted you to develop that based on race initially. And I would be interested in one of the stories, although I can be a crying kind of guy. I don't know whether you can get me to cry on a webcam, but, you know, but what brought you there? And then I would be kind of interested in one of the stories.
Sure. So, you know, so it's interesting, you know, for me, so I grew up in Canarsie, Brooklyn, which in a lot of ways was a phenomenal neighborhood. It was like half Jewish, half Italian,
groups for me anyway.
Very similar cultures in a lot of ways, although I love the Italian food. I was happy to have my Italian friends there. But it was, you know, it was pretty much all white, you know, what the initial thing for me that got me thinking about these issues were, it was in the 70s and they started busing African-American kids in from other neighborhoods when they started the forced busing to integrate schools. And the parents came around literally with bullhorns, riding their cars around, creating a boycott of the schools, right? To boycott the schools because they were busing the black kids in. And my parents, who were not activists, my parents were, you know, lower middle class folks. We always had food on the table, but they were, you know, working paycheck to paycheck. Later in life, they became more comfortable, but, you know, they were busy making a living. They weren't out, you know, on the streets. Yeah. But they sat me down and they said, Corey, listen, I don't care what your friends are doing. I don't care what other people are doing. But number one, we value education and we're not letting you miss school. And number two, we don't believe in this. So you're going. Okay. And I was one of three kids in my homeroom class out of 45 that were there for those 2 weeks while they boycotted the schools. And then, you know, it went to court and the court upheld the busing and people sent the kids back. So like that was something that struck me. I became friendly with some of the black kids, and we played basketball together and football together or whatever. And, you know, ever since then, it sort of, you know, kept going. And then a little later, you know, I started hanging out in diverse environments. I was very active in the Hunger Project and spent some time in Ghana and Uganda and India. And so I was spending time with a lot of diverse people. And then this was the real trigger for the project, which was Bill Bradley was running. It was, I remember it was the millennial. It was Y2K. The whole world was going to fall apart. You know, the end of 99, if you remember that.
Back when Gore invented the internet.
Exactly. and I'm out actually in California I went on like a meditation retreat. I said, I'm not going to deal with all this craziness. I don't want to, you know, I've gotten sort of past my partying days on New Year's. And I said, I just want to spend a quiet, you know, reflective time. And we were staying in a hotel. The meditation thing was at a convention center. And I wasn't watching TV, but one night I came back and for some reason I was compelled to turn on the TV, and I flip on the TV and Bill Bradley's running for president at the time. And I hear he's at St. Anselm College speaking to students. And this is a paraphrase. It's not exactly what he said, but basically what I hear him say when I immediately turn on the TV is, if you've never had a conversation about race with a person of another race, you're part of the problem. And my first reaction to that was, that's a pretty bold statement for a presidential candidate. And then I started thinking about even myself, where I ran in more diverse environments than some people I knew. And we talked about intimate stuff. We would talk about our families. We'd talk about our sex lives. We'd talk about our, you know, our goal, whatever. And we would talk about the issues around race, right? We would talk about, yeah, you know, the political and the, but did we, the way I interpreted it, and by the way, I've never spoken to Bill Bradley about this and I should reach out. Like, I don't know how he meant it, but the way I interpreted it was like a really deep, intimate conversation about race. And I decided that I want to do that, right? So I came back from this meditation retreat. It took me 3 months to get the courage to pick up the phone and make the first phone call to a person of a different background. And the way I opened it was, I said, I told them a story about hearing Bill Bradley say that. And you know, long story short, I just had the most amazing conversations. I mean, people I had known for years, we never went that deep, right? It became so authentic. It became so intimate. And there was something that, and a lot of these relationships were good relationships, but there was something different after the, you know, the common result was deeper intimacy. So I got together a diverse group of people, created it as a project. There was even a discussion back then, should we only focus about race? Should it just be about difference? And the thinking was, let's start it very focused, because otherwise it could be a bunch of, you know, different things. And we started doing these events, you know, college campuses, like I said, you know. Yeah. So that's how it came about. In terms of a story, there are so many I can tell, but I'll tell one. We were in Pennsylvania doing this as in a community group. And so it was all like, it was, you know, so, you know, some places like the university, sometimes would be professors or students, and, you know, they would be like, the professors would be mandated to be there. You know, these are all people who chose to be in the room, and we had no idea who they were, because they were just coming in, you know, through, you know, we had put it out, people we knew locally, they had invited people, whatever. And there's one pairing that is this a young African-American woman with this older white gentleman. Turns out that it's her father-in-law. And when his son married her, he disowned them. He did not like the fact that his son was marrying an African-American woman. It was unacceptable to him. How she got him to, and, you know, it had been a few years, not that long, but a few years that they'd been married. I assume they've been dating for a little while before that. And somehow she got him to go to this thing.
Wow.
And he's sitting there in the beginning, you know, like this, you know, really sort of closed off and whatever. And by the end of this thing, and we really set it up, and the way this works is it's one-on-one. You're facing each other. Like, the chair's like this. There's nothing in between you. You are with each other.
Yeah.
And I see that they have tears in their eyes, you know. And in the debrief afterwards, he got up and he accepted her. He apologized. And he accepted her into the family and told her he loved her. So, you know, I could talk about more macro stuff we've done. But for me, that's the epitome of the impact of this work. You know, if you could bring two people together, bring families back together because of it, you know. So I told you I'd get tears.
Well, you got me choked up, and I got tears in my eyes. They're not running down. So it's interesting to me with what I've gone through in my life experience, how often people, and in particular men, have difficulty being authentic and being vulnerable. You don't have to share every little detail, but even going deep enough. And I can see how that would be very touching. I mean, that's very meaningful work. And I do have to credit, you know, thank the man, thank God, whatever motivated him to come there with his daughter-in-law when he had such intense feelings. And then, you know, my thanks to you, Corey, of you came up with some questions that helped them have a breakthrough.
Yeah.
I mean, how powerful is that? You know, I can tell by the way you're talking that with all the stuff you've done on the legal side and had all these successes and all this stuff on negotiation and et cetera, I mean, this is the stuff that really hits home. This is the stuff that lives on.
It does. And listen, it's been I came to a place in my life pretty early on, like even when I was in my 30s, that I had just established my firm and started doing stuff with the Hunger Project and started doing some of the work with young women's empowerment and race relations stuff, like that, for me, it's about service. It's about impact, right? And even in, you know, the way I look at, even when I'm doing a deal for an entrepreneurial client, I'm always looking at what that is helping them achieve is their goals, and it helps them take care of their family. It helps them send their kids to the colleges that they want them, you know, helps them retire in a certain way, and hopefully helps them to be freed up to also make the impacts that they want to make in whatever causes or, you know, things that they believe in. So that context is there for me, you know, throughout everything. And, you know, sort of coming back to the theme of showing up as your whole self, I mean, this is something I never used to share. And now I do like that kind of experience, but also, so my purpose in life is to bring people together across perceived differences so that we realize we're all one, right? I know that's what I'm here for. And I travel in, and I have a unique, when I say unique, I'm not like I'm the only one, but like, right. But I have a unique opportunity in that I span a lot, you know, I'm in corporate boardrooms, you know, it's a stereotype, right? This is not always, but I'm in corporate boardrooms with right wing, you know, Republican folks, and I'm in, you know, and I know left radical activist folks who are disrupt, you know, out on the street. Like there's an interesting, you know, and by the way, just as a little thing, because of the project, people think it's the other way around. I actually met my wife, who's African American, because we were introduced because of my conversations about race project.
Oh, really?
And we've been married now for coming on 16 years. So, so in any case, I have a broad range of people that I interact with, right? And I grew up in a family where my parents canceled out their vote for 50 and some odd years. My dad passed away a few years ago, but you know. My parents were on different political backgrounds, which like nowadays is probably the biggest difference that you would never like forget race, forget, you know, whatever, you know, probably Democrats. No, you can't, you know?
Yeah.
So I sort of come from that background of bridging, you know, of bridging gaps. So for me, you know, it's interesting. People say, how does that relate to, you know, Authentic Enterprises and your work on that side? Well, you know, I'm on Authentic Enterprises. My commitment is to inspire authenticity so that companies profit and people prosper. Now, when I get in there, listen, I'll be straight. It's a little bit of a Trojan horse approach, because if I go in and I tell companies that I'm going to come in and I'm going to, you know, work to have people look deep inside themselves and transform themselves, right? I'm not saying nobody would hire me, but you know, for the most part,
be pretty close.
Right. But if I tell them that I'm going to come in and help them negotiate better, which by the way, I will significantly, right? And I tell them it's authentic negotiating, that's actually a corporate buzzword, has been for a while. I don't think they truly know what that means a lot of times, but they're open to that. Authentic, oh, that's interesting, right? And then I get to bring transformation along with that so that, because listen, when people look deeper inside themselves to try to figure out how to negotiate better, what they really want and they don't want, any kind of introspective into what your truth is gets you in that mode of looking inside yourself. And because I believe that there is a universal truth that we are all one people, right? And every religious and spiritual tradition says that in one way or the other, right? We're all God's children, love thy neighbor, we're one consciousness, you know, whatever, however you want to express it, Eastern, Western philosophy, et cetera. I think it's a core principle of life. So this may seem to be a leap, but I feel like if I get people being introspective and learning about and become self-aware, learning about themselves, they'll get connected to their truth, which will eventually connect them to a universal truth, which will change the world. You know, I'm not saying I'm going to, you know, but we all play a role.
Well, I think that's awesome. And I think that's a good place for us to end with kind of that challenge for people. And Corey, I want to thank you for being with us. I think the United States would be a totally different place if more attorneys had your view on authenticity and ethics and bringing people together instead of selfishness and greed. And so I really want to thank you. I know your schedule's just swamped and living half your time, you know, in Marina Del Rey and a quarter in Brooklyn and a quarter on the road, whatever. And I just, it's been great having you on, and I hope we can catch up with each other separately, kind of talk more, and I can learn more about what you're doing and share notes. So our audience, you know, you got a challenge for your audience, our audience, as far as having an authentic conversation with someone or something else like that. I mean,
yeah,
I
love it. Yeah, listen, I would love, you know, whether it's a conversation with somebody of a different background or whether you're in a negotiation or in a key business relationship, just start looking authentically inside, on what you really care about. What are you here to do? What impact do you want to make? What do you want it to look like? And there's some resources, my website's coreykupfer.com, CoreyKupfer.com. I have like resources on there, videos. I've got this authentic negotiating success quiz. If you want to find out whether you're an authentic negotiator, you can fill that out. It's 11 questions. You'll get feedback. I want to be a resource in whatever way I can to you all. The biggest thing is, listen, here's what I have to say. Whatever is holding you back from building a deeper relationship with somebody, whether that's cross culture, whether that's with a coworker, everybody else probably has the same fears. And my experiences and other people's experiences that the moment you're willing to be the one to get more intimate, to break that, to go to a more authentic place, it opens a space that gives permission for other people to do that. And it's pretty much always positive and it alters everything. So my challenge to you is just pick one relationship, one opportunity in whatever circumstance it is and go do that, in the next few days.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Corey. Thanks for being with us. And thanks to our audience. You have a great day. Great week.
Thanks, David. Take care.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. I really enjoyed talking with Corey Kupfer today. He is a sharp guy, and I love his focus on authenticity. I know there's some nuggets there, things that you can apply in your life to improve in business and also in your personal life.